Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rachel Stewart. She's a writer/journalist and current columnist with the New Zealand Herald, 2016 winner of the Opinion Writer of the Year at New Zealand's Canon Media Awards. Ex-agricultural leader turned dairy industry critic, falconer, protector of rivers, and everything wild. So first, thank you for your work in defense of the wild, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
So the first question is, can you just talk about the state of New Zealand rivers and threats to them? When somebody from the United States thinks about New Zealand rivers, we think of just pristine, beautiful, full of fish, and everybody's happy rivers. So is that the case?
No, sadly. I think it has been the case, and I think New Zealand is a country that has high expectations of itself in terms of the environment. Unfortunately, we've kind of drunk the Kool-Aid on that and believed our own bullshit around our tourism marketing. What's progressively happened and has now got to an absolute zenith is that the dairy industry is our, for many years, has been, well, decades, has been our biggest earner. And now tourism has taken over. So those two don't actually do very well together because tourists do come here to see our wonderful rivers, of which we do still have some, but only in areas where dairy farming is not really happening. So maybe in the South Island with the high country, lovely, beautiful rivers. But what's happening in most of the lowland rivers is the nitrates and nitrogen from fertilizer and cow effluent and more particularly their urine. Is entering the waterways and has been doing it for decades, but has now reached a point where we're losing 72% of our native fish have gone. It's actually a crisis, but it's a crisis that, like most governments and industry, fight every step of the way. I have made a name journalistically by taking that on, and when I started writing about what was going on with our rivers and what was happening in the dairy industry, of which that is my background, my family were dairy farmers and sheep farmers, So what's happening is that they're putting all their might behind shutting us down from talking about it. And, you know, it is a big earner for New Zealand and we are a small country. But let me put it in context. We've got 4.5 we've reached 5 million people now. We have something like 8 million cows. So we have more cows than people. They produce 28 times more effluent, than humans a day, of course. And what happens is there's no septic or sewerage situation for that. So it's absolutely just falling onto the ground, then it rains or whatever, it goes down into the substrate and into the rivers and pollutes them. And it's been happening for years. And in fact, freshwater scientists believe, and I live with one, it's probably a lag time of 40 years before the worst hits. So we've got a situation right now in Canterbury where we have 1.3 million cows on the Canterbury Plains, which is a very shallow soil, they've just found E. coli in four rivers, and the E. coli from cows, despite people saying, you know, the Federated Farmers, which is, you know, a national farm union, saying, oh, well, it's probably human or it's probably birds or the usual stuff, Derek. You know all about this stuff. So it's an ongoing battle. I don't know how we're going to win it. I don't know that we will, but I think we have a situation where New Zealanders do hate it when our rivers are unswimmable. We have a history of summer days like today. I mean, it's Christmas Day in New Zealand today. A lot of people will be out trying to swim in those rivers, and they can't anymore because they're getting sick. And that's when the wake-up call will start to happen, maybe when we lose somebody, because it's getting close. So that's the situation for us down here. Maybe it's partly because our tolerance for this thing where rivers aren't, you know, beautiful anymore. And sometimes they look really beautiful, but of course you can't tell by looking. That New Zealanders don't put up with this very well. So we're getting to a point where maybe something may happen. We have a new government and they're a little bit more, they say better things about the environment. That doesn't mean anything really. Hopefully the tide will turn, but it will take a death or two, I suspect. So that's the situation.
So I have a couple questions. One is, sure. And just save this one for later, that so often, so many journalists I encounter, there's this great line by William James, which is the press is the hired agent set up by a moneyed system. Let's see. The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And so often my experience of journalists who have not yet been fired is that they don't come on as strong as you do, and instead they have to talk about how important the dairy industry is, and so this is for later because I want to ask you other stuff first, but I just want you thinking about this. It's like, how do you keep your job? And so now, yeah. Back to the original, the question I really wanted to ask first, though, is you said something about 40-year lag time, and can you explain how that works? Because, okay, they poop on the ground, and some of that turns into soil, which is good. Some of it turns into plants, which is good. Some of it runs off into rivers, which is bad. And now, where do we get the 40 years?
Well, because New Zealand's predominantly, and actually urine is the main problem. Although, you know, cow shit's not great, but urine is the main problem. What happens is in an industrial agriculture like we've got here, and dairy farming is, you know, huge, we're putting too much nitrogen fertilizer on. That's another big problem. So it's years and years and years of that still coming down. You know, like we've got thousands, hundreds and millions of acres of land that's being used for years, and it's all got to filter through the soil, and that takes time. So the feeling is that and then there's the aquifers, of course, underground. So the feeling is that lag time's still coming, that we have not seen the worst of it, and that's just basic geography and basic time it takes for that stuff to carry on. If we stop dairy farming tomorrow, like completely, they still reckon we've got 40 years to go before we hit the worst. So that's what the scientists tell me.
So it takes 40 years for the pollutants to filter from the surface down to the aquifer.
It can, yes. Okay. The worst is yet to come.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about the dairy industry itself. You said the number of cows, but are these generally, when you say cows, are these happy Guernseys kicking their heels up in fields? Are these, I believe they're called CAFOs, the confinement animal factory?
Oh, no, we don't do that here. To be fair, that's part of the problem for New Zealand. Well, actually, it's great for New Zealand. We do have while I sound negative about the dairy industry, I also understand it very well because I've, you know, it got me through life. We have mostly Frisians and Jerseys cows. They are outside on the paddocks. We have very, very little containment. We only have containment on sort of feed pads in very, very cold environments, and I think there's only very few. Mostly New Zealand cows are out all seasons on, you know, bucolic-looking fields eating lush grass. Those bucolic fields, of course, are only there because of the amount of fertilizer that we use that we get from the Western Sahara and, you know, destroy people in the process of that. That's a whole other story. So we have this, we do have this situation where tourists do come here and they see this lovely industry and the cows walking gently towards the shed, might be 3 miles. It used to be, you know, maybe half a mile to walk to the shed. Now it is industrial now. It's bigger. Our milking sheds are bigger. Everything is massive. We are the biggest producers of milk in the world. We have the biggest dairy factories. Fonterra is our cooperative. It's the biggest in the world, pretty much, per capita, I mean, in terms of scale. So it's huge, but it still looks quite nice because it's outside. And you don't see the kind of the knocking the male calves on the head when they're born because they're no use. And so you kill them because they take up too much milk to feed, so you might as well just knock them off. You know, that's the kind of the other side of this industrial thing. Plus the fact that we bring in masses of palm oil, PKE, palm kernel expeller. We're the biggest importers of that. That comes from obviously where you destroy your orangutan habitats. we do it as a supplementary feed. And of course, when you're bringing in supplementary feeds, you're not doing it on your own property. You're beholden to the industrial model. So it's all done in a way that still looks kind of nice to, from the outside looking in, but it just is not. Yeah.
And to be clear, I mean, I'm sorry for my ignorance of New Zealand, but the ruminants don't belong in New Zealand, do they? Or are there native ruminants?
No, there's no native ruminants. They don't belong right here, no. Just like anywhere else, just industrial farming. Yeah.
So it's interesting because the problem, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'm going to say something, and please disagree if this is incorrect.
Sure.
So
sure.
The problem is not that they're doing a strictly industrial model where you have, you know, 10,000 hogs confined in this area of a couple football fields, and the poop is directly outside. The problem is, I guess, finish that sentence.
Scale. The problem is too many. The problem is the size of it. We have a country that, you know, is small, and it's geologically very young, and we have lots of empty spaces, and we're filling them up with where we would naturally normally have sheep. You know, we had sheep for years, and it does not do the damage that dairy does. So it's the scale. We've gone from, 15 years ago, 1.5 million cows, maybe. That was, and certainly when I grew up, we I was born in 1962. We had a small dairy farm with like 6 bales. It was a walk-through shed, very old. We had never had more than 100 cows. I think my father got to 99 and never went over 100. Not saying it was idyllic, but it was kind of. And everything, we had 80 acres, I think, on that bottom farm, on the dairy farm. And it educated 4 kids and fed everybody. And, you know, now we're talking about the average herd being something like 1,600. But there are herds that are sitting at 7,000-8,000 now. And they're owned by tribes even, you know, Maori tribes. And you know about that. You've been down here. So they will say, the indigenous people will say, well, we do it better and we do it, you know, and that's fine. They can say that. But it's no different from anybody else doing it. So Ngāi Tahu, for instance, in the South Island, in Canterbury, have huge dairy farms going on with thousands and thousands of cows. So it's greed. It's the usual thing happening. Intensification. So there's a huge push in New Zealand now, which I'm part of, particularly by Greenpeace actually down here, to educate people about regenerative and biological farming. And you know, some farmers, to be fair, are hearing it and getting it and starting to realise if they were to destock and go back to a more natural system, and some are testing it and some are learning that actually they can make just as much money. So it is starting to happen. I think it'll be too little too late. But yeah, it's the sheer scale of what we've done, and we've been encouraged, New Zealand farmers have been encouraged to do this. Of course, they're all beholden to the banks right now. The banks are nervous as hell, because the economy is looking pretty dire and all around the world. So yeah, it's the usual thing, Derek, you know?
Well, I was just going to say, so this sounds like if we just plugged in some different words, we could be talking about the transformation of small family farms into large corporate farms.
Yes.
Something that I've been hammering just lately because of legalization of marijuana is that it's the exact same thing with marijuana farming in Northern California, where all the tiny farmers are being driven out and replaced with huge conglomerates with block-size greenhouses.
Yeah.
And this is just – it's the Luddites, for crying out loud. This is this is the transformation of artisanal, individual small family-owned concerns with larger conglomerates.
That's it. That's it. It's happening everywhere. I mean, New Zealand's a big beer brewer, right? We do a lot of craft beer down here, really interesting craft beer. And, of course, when they get to a certain scale and everyone's drinking the beer, you know, our huge breweries take over and buy them. So, you know, it's the same. You know, you can't get away from it.
So let's go a slightly different direction for a second. And can you talk about well, I'm going to give you 2 choices again. You can choose whichever one you want. One is, can you talk about some of who and what has been lost in terms of the rivers? You said fish are down 70%. Can you talk a little bit about what the rivers used to be like prior to all this? And the other question is an entirely different direction. Is there has been, you have received at various points pushback from the dairy industry, and I find, including death threats, and I've received death threats. I just find it both horrifying and fascinating how so often death threats are the go-to means of discourse when, especially when an economic entity is thwarted. So you can go either one of those or both of them.
Okay, first, the rivers. Well, New Zealand has a lot of long finials and short finials, and they're found only here. I think you know a bit about that. We have white bait. We have things that are only found in New Zealand, native fish that are only found in New Zealand, short-jawed kokopu. We have some really interesting species. They're just on the way out, basically. And, of course, when rivers are polluted, you find the invertebrates disappear, and then the whole situation gets very... Well, it starts to break down, so we're in that mode. 72% of our native fish are gone. That's according to one of our freshwater scientists recently. He keeps plugging this figure, so we know it's bad. And there don't seem to be too many protections around them, and the government's not too worried because they're just fish, you know, and eels are ugly and all that stuff. Whereas to me, they're taonga, they're a treasure, they're precious. So, yeah, big trouble there. The
are
other one...
Fresh, are they freshwater eels or are they anadromous?
No, freshwater eels, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Does New Zealand have any anadromous fish?
Well, when you say that, just to clarify, because I'm not that schooled up on that word.
Like salmon go to the ocean and then they come back. And in the United States, and in Europe too, a lot of eels will go to the ocean and then they come up to spawn. So it's freshwater spawning.
It's freshwater, but at the end, it's freshwater for about 80 years. If a female eel can live to 80 at the end of her life, she then goes to somewhere around Tonga and has her spawns and then dies. And then those elvers come back up virtually to the same rivers that she left. How they know that, it's an absolute mystery. If you look up about New Zealand long finials, they are an absolute treasure. The thing that it is beyond comprehension that they know to go to this area in Tonga. No one's actually ever found it, where it actually is. They travel thousands to Tonga. Then they do the thing, and then the elvers, the babies that survive, come back up to those same rivers. But she dies at the end of 70 to 80 years. Her eyes start to turn blue, because I've had them out the back of my place, and they kind of, you know, feed them. And then, you know, when we were growing up, we had eels that lived there my whole childhood and then left when they were around 80. And, you know, I can remember my mother being upset that they'd gone, and, you know, and their eyes go sort of a funny blue, and then suddenly they disappear. And they're all heading up to Tonga, but they do it at the end of their life, which I found fascinating. And then they give birth, they do this thing, and then they just die. Their stomach just empties out and they just end up starving to death and die. It's bizarre.
And what did you feed them when you were a kid?
Oh, we feed them meat, like leftovers from roasts or anything disgusting. They love it, you know.
And how big?
Huge. I mean, I've got, let me think. We talk in terms of meters, but let me think in feet maybe.
Either way.
Okay. You can get eels that are 3-4 meters long.
4 meters long?
Yeah.
So that's like 15 feet, 13 feet.
We have photos of those eels around, particularly years ago, not so much now, because they die a lot earlier now because we're running out of them. And they're fat. I mean, they are fat. And you would not want to go in there with blood on you because they will, I mean, I've been in situations where they've started, attacking me and start writhing around on your leg, and they're incredible animals. I adore them. People think I'm nuts, but I love them. Yeah.
And those are one of the fish getting hammered.
Oh yeah, they're on the way out, you know, long fin eels. The New Zealand long fin eel. The short fin eels, they're a bit smaller, they've got a different area where the fin is obviously, and they're doing a bit better, but the long fin eels are definitely in big trouble.
And do these long fin eels, do they not reproduce until they're 80?
Round about, yeah.
They think about have to live 80 years before they,
yeah.
Well, no, no wonder they're getting hammered.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not getting, and of course, that's right, they can't, they get, and of course people, see what's interesting is that Maori fish them, and they have indigenous rights to eels, that's fine, and they have a quota system, but actually they are voluntarily stopping fishing to give them a break. They're actually, some tribes are voluntarily giving them a break, which Pākehā, white New Zealanders, are not doing. We just keep doing it for, you know, this is what gets me, Derek, is that the long finial, this precious treasure, only found here, is then used for pet food in Japan. You know? And it's got this beautiful life, this cycle of life that they, that we will send it to Japan and they use it for pet food. And they eat it too. But they use it for pet food. And I find that absolutely appalling.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's appalling that we even eat them really anymore. But, you know, this is happening to so many things. So that's what's going on in our rivers. In terms of the second
question. I'm guessing too, just from what I know, I live just north of the Klamath and, prior to conquest, the Klamath would literally be, quote, black and roiling with salmon. And I've seen pictures of lampreys. Lampreys are eel-like fish. Yes. And I've seen pictures of lampreys that they're so thick that, like, a rock is covered to a foot and a half with lampreys.
That's
and I'm guessing, I could easily be wrong, but I'm guessing that prior to conquest, the eels were pretty much the same, that they were... You know, if you go to a river, the chances are really good you're going to see a bunch of eels.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, there were times when I've heard stories from, you know, relatives that, you know, 100 years ago kind of stuff, that you'd just go into any old lake and it was just pouring, just black, shiny bodies just going all over each other, just, you know. And you could always feed eels too because they always love meat, so they come up to you. They're easy to catch and... You know, if you can get them like that, and it's just, yeah, everything's changed. It's, New Zealand was exactly the same. I've been to the Klamath, actually. I've spent a bit of time in there, and I came through where you live, Crescent City, in, a couple of years ago, and, it's a lovely area. That Klamath River's beautiful.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I believe it was 2 years ago for the first time the Indians they had their standard Klamath Salmon Festival, but there weren't any salmon.
Right.
Anyway, so let's jump in the death threat direction.
Right. I've had a lot. The problem for me now is that I'm inured to it, and I don't think that's necessarily healthy. I have had so many death threats in the last 8 years or so since I've been writing that, about these issues, that I just doesn't even really register. But I have had them come onto the property and leave me notes, and I've been left a note and had cow shit delivered into the middle of the driveway so I couldn't get out, and did see the guy that did that, so the police talked to him. But that's toned down a bit now. It's almost like when I started writing about dairy issues in 2010, it was quite radical, and I think that I was used by a provincial newspaper that I started with as the kind of the whack job that they could all laugh at, you know, because it was such a big dairying area. So when I started talking about these issues, and I've never changed tack, I just keep going, they just thought, well, she's got a good style of writing and we like her, and they knew who I was. But it was getting so much, I was getting so much hate that I think they thought, oh, this is good, you know. So that's how I've kept my job initially. And then what happened was, I think some of the things that I predicted started just unraveling before everyone's eyes, and I started to be taken a lot more seriously, even though I'm still hated by the deer industry. There's a grudging respect there, though. Then I won this award, which everyone was absolutely shocked at. And it suddenly elevated me into the big leagues in terms of the New Zealand Herald, which, you know, has a million readers every day. So, which is nothing in the American scale, but here it's quite big. So I think, this death threat, rape threat thing, it's just so empty and meaningless to me now. It doesn't mean it would never happen, but I actually suspect, and I'm sure you do too, that if someone's going to kill me, they're not going to, broadcast it to the world first. So I kind of just pretty relaxed about it.
You know, I've received a boatload of death threats over the decades too, and and I have lots of friends who have, and it just, it always, I guess the thing that, that just strikes me as weird is that, yeah, there are plenty of foresters whom I hate, and there are plenty of, you know, fisheries biologists who are on the wrong side and who are signing off on destructive mm-hmm. timber sales. And I hate them, and honestly, if I saw them in town, I don't know, pretend not to notice them or something. But it would never occur to me to send them a death threat. And the point is, this is, you know, basically every activist I know has encountered this. I just find, well, and see, here's another thing that's really weird too, is something that changed my perspective on receiving death threats was when I learned that professional baseball players get death threats too. And it's like, for crying out loud, if you're going to send a death threat to a professional athlete, then...
Yeah.
Anyways, you're wet, and it's just, I guess the thing that's striking me is that it's just an extraordinary thing that that if you express an opinion that someone doesn't like, and especially an opinion that goes against the way they make their living, it just does strike me that death threats are almost standard.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And what we're finding now with the lack of free speech that we're encountering from, you know, the woke left, I guess, if you want to put it any other way, is that free speech is kind of, I mean, you know, if I don't like someone's opinion, I just kind of don't read it or don't even, I just go, oh yeah, and carry on. I just don't, it's beyond me that we can't have these conversations. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, again, it doesn't matter whether the issue we're talking about is, you know, the transgender issue, which both you and I have been embroiled in, or whether it's dairy or whether it's logging. It seems that there's a standard response, which is, okay, so it's time for me to come to your house and kill you.
Yeah. I think everyone thinks that we're just big, you know, we're just big pussies who, you know, that environmentalists are just big pansy type people who are going to be scared off by, a threat of death. I mean, you know, I'm one of the toughest people I know because having to take on and you are too. I mean, my God, we're taking on the biggest earners in the country. We're taking on massive, vested interests. And, I think that, do they really think we're scared of them? It's beyond my comprehension. That does not scare me. What scares me is the end of the world. The end of the world as we know it in terms of, you know, humanity, you know, hurtling to its doom. That scares me. But, well, actually it doesn't. I've probably got used to that too. But I'm not scared of humans, you know, threatening me. That's the least of my concerns, really.
So let's do talk. I don't know if this is a fair question, and if it isn't, you can say so. But okay. I know some people have said that I am courageous for writing the stuff I do, and I never feel courageous. I just feel like I get stuck in the I'm writing along, and it's just, oh, this is what's true, and I'm just sort of following it like a dog following a scent. And yet it's also true that I know there are a great number of journalists and others who definitely keep their heads down. You mentioned earlier a water expert who puts his head above the parapet. Mm-hmm. And I guess what is it that causes you to write truth about the dairy industry and might cause someone else to not put their head above the parapet? And I'm asking this because all of my work is about trying to get people to, on whatever their issue is, put their head above the parapet. So what can you say to people that will encourage them to stand up for what they think is right? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think, look, I have many journalist colleagues that disappoint me every day. Sometimes I tell them that they do. Recently signed a, New Zealand has been the first country to, recently our new Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has, we've banned all new permits for exploration. So the ones that are already going are going to expire, but there's no more oil exploration happening off the coast of New Zealand now. We've been the first to do it. Now, in some ways that could be meaningless, I don't know, but I signed an open letter that Greenpeace organised to encourage the government to do this, and we won, and it's happened, and we've been lauded around the world for this, because it's quite a statement, really. And I'm proud that New Zealand's done that. So I was the only journalist apart from one other who I encouraged to do it, and she agreed with me that we just had to do it. We had a lot of knowledge about that industry and oil and what it's been doing, fracking and all that stuff, and we just felt we had to do it. And I asked other journalists about it who I really admire, who write really good stuff, and mostly it's to do with social justice and things that, you know, it's not my bag, but it's theirs. And I said, why don't you sign this? Because, you know, why can't we have more people doing this? And to a person, they said, well, we just want to keep we want to keep balance. We want to keep being respected. And I said, so that means I'm not? And they said, well, you know, you do your thing, we do ours, but I want to keep balanced about it. And I just said to them, I just don't have any respect for that. You know climate change is happening. You know what's going on. We all know. None of us disagree on that. Oh, well, no, just couldn't do it. I think it comes down to people wanting to, they consider that if they're in, particularly journalists, sitting there being absolutely balanced about every bloody thing is, you know, they think it's wonderful and great and they'll be respected for it. I don't. I mean, I am literally an opinion writer. Not always, but mostly. So I guess it gives me a bit of leeway. But I don't think their employers would have told them off for it. I really don't. I think that, I think it comes down to personality types. In my opinion, most people hate conflict. And they will keep their head down. And it's to do with their jobs, maybe, but I think partly it's because they just don't want to be seen to be out there changing anything. And of course, that is an indicator of where we're all heading, because we've all sat back and not put our heads, well, not us, you and I haven't, but many people have, and not put our heads above the parapet. And here we are in the situation we are planetarily, which is dire. So I don't understand it. I think for me, I was farming, we got flooded, we lost everything in 2004. It came to the roof, people were rescued off the roofs with helicopters. I watched cattle flowing down the streams, you know, dying, heading out to sea. It was massive. And that was my wake-up call. Something happened in that moment that made me think about things. And I've always been a person who questions everything, and I've always been a little bit outside the box, but that was the moment I realized that I needed to change my thinking. Well, I didn't even think I just did change my thinking about climate. And then I started reading and reading and reading and reading and educating myself, and I just suddenly went from being kind of, you know, like most people, just kind of accepting the way life is to seeing things that once you've seen them, you can't unsee them. And so here we are. You know, and I don't have, like you, I just go down this track, and I know what I know, and I know what I see, and I write about that. And there's no other way, you know. I've got to go down fighting, and we're all going to die, and I want to be remembered as someone who had a go at it and tried to change the way that we see all of capitalism, all of the relationship between humans and the environment. I went from farming, you know, a whole farming background, to not being able to send anything off to slaughter anymore in the industrial model. So that was a major shift, and I am glad I woke up. So a lot of people just haven't got there yet, Derek, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, one of the things I think about a lot is for me, a lot of it has to do with shifting your loyalty away from the economic system and to the natural world. That once I switched my loyalty, everything else is followed. Everything else becomes pretty straightforward. And then all I have to do is think, okay, if I'm going to write a piece about the dairy industry and rivers, if the river could actually be pounding on a keyboard,
yeah,
or could be holding a pen, what would the river say? And exactly. That guides everything I write.
Me too. Me too now. Absolutely. And it's an extraordinary change. Yeah, and money is just, you know, I guess I've always had a sort of, my relationship to money has always been, was always quite complicated before, and now it's really simple. You're right. It's not about the monetary system. It's not about, I have to look in the mirror, you know, and so I don't do anything for money that I don't do anything for money that I can't live with. If my editor said to me tomorrow, look, you got to stop talking about this, or you got to stuff it, you know, just tone it down, or, and he doesn't do that. I just wouldn't do it. I'd just walk, you know, because I'd find another way to, you know, make money somehow. It's just what's happened to me. And it's, look, it's made it look difficult in some ways, but it's opened up doors that I never thought were ever there before. And, you know, I worship nature. This is my religion, you know. This is my religion, and I'm going to stick to that. I believe that the natural world is really all we've got. And we have to, it's precious, and we have to look after it. And that was a massive change for me. And yeah, it's an epiphany, really. It is like finding a new religion in a way, although, yeah, it's kind of not like a religion in the traditional sense, but it was an epiphany, and my eyes opened, and it was a massive change for me, and I'm really glad I had it.
Well, for me, it is a religion, and I'm comfortable saying that because, a religion is supposed to teach us, I believe, how to live together and how to live in place. And it's also supposed to teach us how to experience the divine.
Yes.
In whatever that means. And just from your little description, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that you can perceive the divine in those eels.
Yes.
And, so for me, at least, when, the problem with a lot like Christianity is that you've got this distant sky god, one of many problems, but one of the problems is a distant sky god, and that's not going to really teach you how to experience the divine in a redwood forest.
No.
And you know, the divine has to be here in the trees and in the eels and in everybody else.
That's right.
So let's go back to dairy for a minute and go back to just almost policy. So if they made you the what are they called, czarina? If they made you the czar, if they made you the king or queen, the queen of all things dairy in New Zealand.
Yeah, the agricultural minister, the minister of agriculture. Yep.
Yep. So your minister of agriculture appointed tomorrow, and the rule is you cannot in the first 3 months get rid of capitalism. So you have to continue the framing conditions that we have. I mean, we all know that if you could, you know, if we really want to save the planet, we have to get rid of industrial civilization. You can't do that right now. That's like 2 years down the road.
Okay. I guess I would have a better system. I would work out a system of regulations that worked, because the people that regulate the dairy industry are called regional councils. They basically don't seem to do that. They seem to work for the dairy industry. So I would make them accountable, and I would make them make the dairy industry accountable in terms of leaching. So by leaching, I mean the amount of nitrate. You can work out pretty closely how many cows on what sort of land under what conditions are leaching into the environment. So you'd work on tightening those controls. Then after a few months, I'd say, now we're going to make you destock. You're going to shed, first of all, 20% of your stock. Sorry about this. We're going to compensate you maybe a little bit, but not to the extent that you think you're going to get. And then we're going to progressively over time maybe destock another 20% the year after, and then another, you know, and then to the point where we get to maybe 50% of the national herd. There would be some incentives along the way, because I'm not naive enough to think that you can't make farmers do something without some financial subsidies, because that's what they are. So there'd be a number of things, but I would then look at investing very heavily in biological regenerative farming, so that everybody has to be able to make hay or silage or feed from their own properties. So I guess I'd be putting a massive effort and energy into biological farming. So that would be basically the framework that I would be working in.
And, you know, an idea I had several years ago was that if I were, you know, made in charge of soil across the country, One of the things I might do is measure the soil on everybody who has more than, let's say, I don't know, 1,000 acres, 5,000 acres, yeah. some fairly large amount of property, so you're not worried about somebody who has an acre. You basically test the soil every 5 years, and if the soil is not both deeper and healthier on its own terms, then the land is seized.
Right. Cool.
This plan would last about 3 minutes before my head would be on a pike.
That's dead right. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to say the same thing, but, you know, we know it's pretty much unworkable. But yes, I agree.
Yeah, so my point is in terms of the regenerative farming, that you know, if you're going to do farming, that's the way to go.
Absolutely. There's no other way to go. You know, New Zealand's got this idea that we're supposed to feed the planet, and we do. We do feed the planet. It's a myth. We're not here to feed the planet. We're here to feed ourselves, you know. Globalization is this ridiculous construct now. We really have to shut the gates and feed ourselves. So we need to, yeah. If we don't cut to the chase soon, we'll get there because we'll be forced to. And there'll be no globalization in a very short period of time, I don't think, you know.
Which will be great for the eels, because I learned this several years ago when I was talking with somebody from Canada who used to see 4 or 5 grizzly bears every single day, and now saw a grizzly bear every month. And the reason was because hunters had discovered the market for bear gallbladder in China.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that global demand, even for something as esoteric as a bear gallbladder, no natural population, no matter how strong, can support infinite demand.
No.
And that's what global marketplace creates. I mean, for crying out loud, you end up sending eels to Japan and gallbladders to China and oil to New Zealand.
That's right. It's crazy.
And it's just insane.
It's insane. And it's unsustainable, and it will end. And I'm looking forward to that day. Yeah.
I am too, and you know, all of my work, so I'm going to ask you what all your work is about. All of my work is really predicated on one premise, which is this way of life cannot last, and when it comes down, I would prefer that there is more of the world left than less. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all we can hope for, really, I think. Logically, I agree. Yeah.
And so, tell people just a little bit more about your work. How can they read your work? How can they learn more about you? And how can they help you in your struggle against the destruction of rivers by dairy farms?
How they can help me? Well, read me. Yeah, read me's good. I mean, you can find me in the New Zealand Herald, Rachel Stewart. It's all there. Google, it's around. It'd be great if I'm getting a larger overseas audience now because we're a pretty small country, and the stuff I'm writing about is pretty global in many ways. But, you know, of course I live here, so I have a vested interest in this place. I love this place. It's my home. But I love the planet, you know. So it's, people can help. For me, everything about my work is once I realize the interconnectedness. I mean, you know it in farming, to be fair. You sort of do know about interconnectedness because you know that what you do down that paddock is going to affect something in this paddock. And you can only do so much on your own property and without ruining everything. So farmers do know that. They know it on some basic level. And I think when I took that background and stepped up to be, you know, more than an environmentalist, I'm something more than that. But it runs everything I write about. It runs everything I do. I discovered falconry too in the middle of all that. So that's a whole other subject, but hunting with birds and eagles and, you know, in America mostly, that's where I started doing it. So that interconnectedness there and being close to the wild informs everything I do. I guess I'm a little bit disappointed in humanity, and that would be the biggest understatement of this interview. So what informs my work? I guess it's what you just said. It's the religion of the environment and nature. And I guess, you've convinced me, Derek. This is my religion. I mean, I knew it, but I just... The New Zealand way is to kind of play it down and not say things like that. So, no, this is my religion, and I'm confirming that here today with you.
Well, thank you so much for all of your tremendous work, and thank you for your writing, which I very, very much enjoy. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Rachel Stewart. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.